Hi, and welcome to Ones and Twos, FP's economics podcast. Every week we take a couple data points, use them to try to explain the world. I am Cameron Abadi, FP's deputy editor, with you in Ditchley Park, which is a country house in Oxfordshire, England, where I've been attending a conference on climate change and national security. With us, as always, is Adam Twos, FP's economics columnist and Columbia University professor. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Cam.
So, obviously, it's been a very lively week at Columbia University. We decided we should talk about Columbia and the protests there and the underlying economics, but we're going to get to that probably next week. But this week, we have one data point, and that is $44.8 million, which is the amount of money that the film Civil War has earned in its first 2 weeks at the box office in the United States.
Much anticipated, much discussed, this film by Alex Garland, known for Ex Machina.
And provoking conversation about where a divided nation could lead.
Yet another American Civil War. But talking with its
The premise of Civil War is that a civil war has broken out in the United States. Obviously, not the historical civil war from the 19th century, but a contemporary civil war in which an alliance between California and Texas secede from the Union and conflict ensues. Yeah, the movie's been doing pretty well, but we thought we'd take it as an opportunity to dig into the speculative economics of a potential civil war in the United States. So, Adam, I guess first off, I wanted to ask whether there are any American states or sections of the country that have a sufficient economic basis right now to be standalone countries if they were to secede today. I mean, again, the premise of the movie seems to be that California and Texas would enter some kind of rebelling alliance, but yeah. Is there any section of the country that might even have that basis to pull it off?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating premise, this. There's a helpful map online which outlines the configuration of states in the Civil War. I mean, the plot, I've not seen the film, but the description just sounds completely nightmarish. It just seems like a sort of gore-fest horror movie kind of scenario. So it doesn't look, from what I've read in the online, that the film portrays a very happy economic future. But if you look at the way the map's configured in this disastrous world, where I think some sort of usurpation of national power by the president who goes for a third term produces this breakdown. So Texas and California form one block, and then there's a thing called the Florida Alliance, which extends from Florida across the South to Texas. So it's like much of the Confederacy, I guess. And then there's the New People's Army in the Northwest, and then from DC up to New York, and then the, you know, classic Midwest, Great Lakes and so on, is the Loyalist Zone. I mean, on the face of it, these are kind of reasonably plausible block configurations. One would imagine some sort of pincer movement by California and Texas, if they have organized armies, to squeeze out everything in between and form a contiguous block around the Southwest. California and Texas, New York as well, have economies that are the size of mid-sized European countries. So California's GDP is about the size of Italy, and Texas is about the size of Spain. Do those standalone European countries of that size? I mean, they're certainly sophisticated and large economic entities, but they live, broadly speaking, by trading. That's essential. I mean, no one in their right mind would choose to stand totally alone. It's only the privilege of really large continental size economies like the US, like China, like India, to a degree even Japan, that where their economic size is so large that they can afford to have a trade share of 10-15% or something like that. United States trade share, I think, combination of imports and exports as a share of GDP, is kind of at the same level as India's. It's kind of mind-bending. But when you broke them up, you would imagine that they would all have to trade more. If you took this in a tougher direction and said, well, no, that's off the table, we can't have any trade in this nightmarish world of civil war, so how would they do with self-sufficiency? I mean, you'd have to say that California and Texas-sized chunks, or Spain or Italy-sized chunks of the economy, or South African-sized chunks of the economy, for that matter, or Turkey, for instance, can do most of what it takes to sustain a modern economy, with a partial exception, I think, of ultra high-end, super sophisticated microchip production, for instance. It's not obvious that anyone could do that other than the Taiwanese in Taiwan. But most other things, motor car manufacturer, airplane manufacturer on a modest scale, nuclear reactor development probably, would all be within reach. And if you look at the fundamentals of Texas and California, you know, the fundamentals in the sense of, you know, a sort of bare bones sense of what it's necessary to survive, then they're both major energy producers. They're both fossil fuel producers and renewable energy producers. They rival each other now in solar and wind development. Neither of them has that much coal, but they could do without, and they could just run an oil, gas, nuclear, wind and sun. They do happily, live happily ever after. And then the other thing is that they're both substantial agricultural producers. California in particular would, you know, be living high on the hog. They probably, if they weren't able to export, would have a kind of crash in agricultural prices because they'd have such a huge surplus. I looked at Texas's agriculture. They exist. There is actually a study from 10 years ago about the agricultural self-sufficiency of Texas. And it does have some areas in which it is actually reasonably sufficient, but huge deficits in all of the basics. So corn, soybeans, wheat, sugar, pork. I mean, that may be an effect of where the Texan economy has gone recently. Presumably, they could do lots of beef. Maybe that would substitute. They could, you know, go beef milk rather than pork. But there might be some adjustment there, and they might have to trade at the margin, or maybe sort of raiding parties to, you know, cattle rustling on the gigantic scale. I mean, it is an apocalyptic scenario we're envisioning here. But no, America is as rich as it is in large part because large parts of the country do have a really genuinely astonishingly favorable mix of resources. And even in rather apocalyptic scenarios, like dramatic, very bad climate change scenarios, large parts of the US, though they may then deal with drought or heat waves or water shortage or forest fires or whatever, do in the end have the resources to see their way through that. It partly accounts for America's blasé attitude to that kind of scenario. The problem is the institutional stuff. California can't insure fire risk and so on, but that's not because it's too poor. It's simply because no one in their right mind would take the risk in the private market. So I think it's a matter of institutional design. Hard to imagine they're not being able to somehow cope.
I imagine there would also be just transition costs in that sense as well. I mean, yes, like just because,
indeed, slightly.
I mean, I was reading about this, like, you know, Texas has its own like energy grid, right? But California doesn't. So like, I mean, it struck me that, oh, the United States could just like cut California's power off, right? I mean, like, or maybe I'm misunderstanding
on
that.
On the one hand, on the other hand, if it could also, like Ukraine, build resilience through importing. So the way that Ukraine is surviving right now is it's relying on a westward facing grid that they've managed to establish just before the Russian invasion.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So that's how they're surviving the huge hits they're taking. But then it becomes an import problem. So then you've got to pay for your imports of energy.
That makes sense of why there's a California-Texas alliance. Maybe California is also...
Oh, is the buyer. Yeah, but they're pretty strong in oil.
Interesting. Well, okay. So we've established there's some economic basis for these independent states. But then I wonder, if they declare their secession and this leads to, you know, hostilities... I mean, how easily could seceded states today go about acquiring militaries? I mean, how do new countries in general, I guess, you know, that are not yet unanimously recognized internationally, how do they go about the process of starting military in the first place? And, you know, I was thinking about this in financial terms. I mean, like, when would international markets begin helping, you know, these new countries with financing? I mean, you know, whose recognition do you even need to qualify for sovereign debt bonds, for example?
So if you're an American state, you don't need to invent an army. You have one in the form of the National Guard. So California's, which is, I think, is the strongest in the US, has 24,000 troops, many of whom have combat deployment experience. 38,000 California National Guards men, they're called, I'm sure there were women as well, have been deployed since 2001. So these are units with combat experience. They've taken casualties as well. There are Army, Navy, and Air National Guard. It's one of the ways in which people get military scholarships to go through college in the United States. The Army component of the California National Guard is an 18,000-strong combat brigade with four regiments and integrated combat aviation. I mean, looking at it, if it is what it says on paper, it's probably about as much capacity as the German Bundeswehr can field right now. I mean, the German
Who would win in a war, California versus Germany? Yeah.
I think it would be an open question. So there you are. Texas is slightly smaller, but the American states have militaries. One of the most terrifying things that threatens us in New York, in Columbia University, is rogue senators in Washington calling for the National Guard to be deployed. And I gather this call was actually taken up even by the Columbia leadership in a menacing way. And there are, of course, instances of that. One thinks of Kent State and the disasters of the 1960s in which soldiers in uniform were called onto college campuses. If you'd actually been on Columbia's campus today, you would know how absurdly incongruous that vision is. But that reserve force is there, and it can be deployed in the US and is in emergencies real and imagined. And it serves as a substantial combat force. During America's endless wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were very severely stressed. I mean, California has huge tax and debt capacity, and the only reason it doesn't deploy them even more is various types of domestic fiscal rules and fiscal restraint. The way states bootstrap themselves into the fiscal system can be best studied by looking at periods where lots of new states were being formed, like in the 19th century. And if you look at nation-state formation in the 19th century in Europe, in the Balkans, say, with the emergence of Greece, or then the state that becomes the bit, Serbia, for instance, and then what becomes Yugoslavia or Bulgaria, Romania, these entities, which emerge as nation states in the late 19th, in the course of the 19th century, breaking away from the Ottoman Empire and eventually from the Habsburg Empire. The way they establish the capacity to borrow is by various types of hypothecation. So you attach the revenues of a particular tax stream or business to a private entity, which then generates the income necessary to service the debt. So generally speaking, sovereign debt is distinctive because we treat the sovereign essentially as the taxing power. And the reason why sovereign debt is generally high grade is that states have the option to tax across the board and essentially tax GDP, which is the most diversified flow of income you can have in a society. And that seems like an advantage when you have a well-established, fiscally capable state. When you don't have that, creditors want something more tangible. And so what you would do is you would mortgage, for instance, streams of revenue from tobacco exports or streams of revenue from, there was a raisin monopoly established in Greece for a while because dried fruit was one of the things they would export. And then you put representatives of the creditors on the board of the monopoly that buys raisins or tobacco. So that's the second element. First, you hypothecate, you designate an income stream, and you say, this is what's going to service the debt, potential creditors. And then secondly, we're going to give you some control over this. So we're going to remove this from the discretion of our, as yet, you know, not creditworthy politicians, and we're going to instead put this in the hands of you, the creditors, and that will give you greater confidence because you control the flow. We'll, to an extent, subvert the sovereignty we've just gained by handing a slice of that sovereignty to you, foreign creditors. Then you do advertising, you do propaganda. Ideally, you find yourself some sort of external patron who backs you up. So Serbia would, for instance, cozy up with the French, and they would use the money raised from foreign loans to buy French military equipment, which was sort of doubly, you know, A, you're buying it from a legitimate source, and B, de facto, that state then acquires a kind of protective role in relation to you, having sold you the kit, which is itself military kit, which will then allow you to defend yourself. So you can see the kind of virtuous circles you're trying to establish. In ultimately extreme cases, like China in the late 19th and early 20th century, or the Ottoman Empire in the late 19th century, you hand over control of your taxing capacity to agencies run by foreigners. So you don't just hypothecate particular income streams, but the whole lot. Or in the Chinese case, you even allow foreign agencies to run the maritime customs. So they have their own gunboats paid for by the customs they levy, and the gunboats are armed, provided by Western powers and staffed by Western powers, and they police the Chinese customs, the Chinese coastline, collecting customs revenue so as to enable the Chinese state to raise the money. So it's a very far-reaching subversion of authority. I was thinking, is there anywhere in the world where we can see this right now? And the answer is South Sudan is quite an interesting case. It's the most recently formed African state. And of course, it's based on oil. That was the whole beef, right? A, it's Christian and Southern and Black as opposed to Arab and Muslim and North. And B, it has all of the oil reserves of Sudan. And so essentially what they've done, and they've been able to run up $3.5 billion worth of debt, which is 67% of South Sudan's meager GDP, in a gold rush of oil-backed borrowing, largely to the benefit of the crony elite that runs the newly independent country. And so then you ask yourself, who's lending into this maelstrom? And it's partly IMF and the World Bank, because that's kind of their job and they have to get their hands dirty. And, you know, they know it's going to be a pickle, but they can't really step away. And the other side of this is oil companies. So you've got Sahara Energy, which is a Nigerian-owned billionaire outfit, which is there to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. You have the Chinese Export-Import Bank, which is there to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars. And then the Qatari National Bank, which is there presumably for gas projects to the tune of, again, over $500 million. So they're all in, and that's a typical pattern. So it's resource-based. But, you know, this is why we have blood diamonds, because if you are a militia organization somewhere in Central Africa trying to mobilize resources, you need purchasing power to find the unscrupulous arms dealer who'll sell you ex-Soviet kit from some warehouse somewhere. And what do you, this is the dirty end of this same logic, what do you do to offer that arms dealer the credibility that the bills will actually be paid, something that's evidently worth something, and oil is complicated to ship around and difficult. So you go for mineral, you go for precious minerals that can be, you know, dug up, often in informal mining, packaged, and then sluiced into dirty markets, notably via the Gulf and notably via the Emirates, where there's a sort of don't ask, don't tell policy, especially on gold sales. And so that's what's driving a lot of the parastate, quasi-state, you know, rampaging warfare that's actually going on in Sudan, the what's left of Sudan in the north now, because basically there's this huge gold mining strip across the Sahel, and control of mines gives you the possibility of getting credit and arms purchases.
Okay, so this is fascinating. I mean, you become a sovereign in financial terms, right? I mean, by
having assets you can mortgage.
Yeah, but you establish those assets, you establish these credit lines or credit, you know, this income streams by essentially seizing them somehow. I mean, like, this is basically, it is an act of, there's sounds act, like sort of an act of violence is at the foundation of
sovereignty. And then oddly, to avoid the impasse that is original sin, because if you could seize the resources, you're a person with guns, then obviously you can also just simply default on your debts. So this is what sovereign debt theorists call original sin. You know, it's the nightmare of the rich arms dealer who goes to the Central African location where they're going to unload some weapons. I bring up Central Africa because it's the zone in which so much of this dirty dealing has been done. And the risk, of course, is they hijack you and take you, they kidnap you because with all the weapons that you've provided them with. This is the sort of mafia moment in the deal, right? How do men with guns actually engage in exchange without killing each other at the crucial moment? And the way that you do that is to actually hand control of the assets away. So you establish sovereignty by delegating it in a funny kind of way. And this is a logic which operates internally, right? Through parliamentary processes, no taxation without representation is a mechanism of this kind of delegation. And it happens in an international way when you basically say, yes, we've got these assets, but why should you trust us? Oh, we'll allow you, you will trust us if we actually hand control to you. And you'll trust us even more if we give you the job and we'll pay you out of the revenues for collecting the revenue. So then you know we're not cheating and the money all flows back in an orderly way, quote unquote, right? So you, because you don't trust us, because we're sovereign and we're new. So the combination of the two, sovereignty per se makes you untrustworthy and B, novelty does. So to get around that, you have these delegation mechanisms.
Okay. I mean, it seems to me like it still comes down to monopoly of force, like whoever has the final say.
Now that gives you short-run control, but what it doesn't allow you to do is make credible long-term bargains, which is what you want to do if you want to raise really large amounts of money.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break here, but we will be back in a second to continue talking about the economics of the movie Civil War. So I guess to turn to, in this case, what would be remaining of the United States, you know, whatever rump U.S. remains after this secession process that we're speculating about. I'm curious, yeah, I mean, how easily could this rump, you know, United States afford to fight the rebelling states, in this case, say it's California and Texas? I mean, would it have to cut back on other commitments it's made, or, you know, that the United States has made? I mean, has the United States, moreover, ever even been in the position of fighting a country that's as economically powerful as, you know, some portion of its own territory? You know, if the rebelling state was, again, say, California. I mean, is there any other country in history that the United States has faced that's analogous?
So forgive this unattractive train of thought, but why don't we look at Ukraine and Russia in this light? From the Russian point of view, anyway, what happened is there was the great and glorious Soviet Union, and then a whole bunch of countries seceded, and one of them was Ukraine. And now Russia is in the process of trying to reverse that. So that's analogous to the scenario you're talking about. And we see in the Ukraine-Russia dynamic the logic of this playing out, which is that it's expensive for both sides to contest this, hugely expensive. But Russia, with an economy about 10 times that of Ukraine in terms of sheer size, makes an effort equivalent to about, you know, less than 10% of GDP, we think, somewhere between 5 and 10% of GDP. And its economy is, even with sanctions, not sufficiently disrupted so that the expenditure to GDP ratio, that ratio, the denominator is relatively robust in the Russian case. So the Russian economy will probably grow faster than the US economy this year, according to IMF numbers, which is a staggering fact. And it also, so it means that their war effort against Ukraine's independence is relatively sustainable for them over the long haul. Ukraine is in the reverse position. A, it's a small breakaway state, so it's one-tenth the size of the Russian economy. B, when it's invaded by Russia, which is trying to bring it back, right, it takes a huge hit to its economy, which collapses in 2022 by over 30%. And then as its economy shrinks and it's fighting for its life against superior force, it has to raise defense spending at a much more dramatic rate proportionally than the Russians. So now from a smaller economic base, it's making a proportionally bigger effort, and you end up in the range of 30 to 35%+. And the only way that Ukraine can sustain that is by pulling in outside support. Right? There's no way otherwise that it would be able to survive this very unequal contest, which results precisely from the breakup of a larger power political economic entity that was the Soviet Union, or formerly before that, the Russian Empire. And so now they are engaged in this hugely unequal struggle. It's exactly this example, with Russia being the overmighty former hegemon trying to bring them back in. And that's the tug of war that's going on. And it's testing, as we know, despite the decisions of Congress, I think fundamental questions have got to be asked about the rationality of the Western point at this position at this point, because it's, even with the 60-odd billion or whatever they're getting now, it's not clear what the longer-term rationale is, because the fundamental problem is that Russia no longer accepts this breakaway, and there's a huge imbalance of force between the two bits. And the question is, there's really no way Ukraine can stand on its own. So the question is, how long and at what level are we willing to break back? We, of course, claim it's not a breakaway; it's just the legitimate reassertion of Ukrainian sovereignty. Fair enough, but from the analytical point of view, the Russians see it differently, and they have the power to make that a problem for us on a really large scale. Has America ever been in this? Well, the only bit of America which has is the secessionist Confederacy, which fought the war from a strong base if it hadn't been for the blockade, right? Before the Civil War, the Confederacy, the South, is the export engine of the US economy to a considerable extent, because, you know, they grow far more cotton than they can use domestically, and it's a huge trade surplus generating engine, which is why the South was generally free trade in the US, and the North, which is the more manufacturing oriented centered, is protectionist and nationalist in its outlook. Broadly speaking, we think the North, the Union, outspent the South by a ratio of 2-1. So, and that crushed the South in the end, especially because the blockade and the ability of other markets to do without Southern cotton meant their position was really disastrous, and the Confederacy spirals towards really rapid inflation and economic breakdown. in other all of America's other wars, America has always been the economically superior party. So in relation to Nazi Germany, it was probably 20%. You know, it's more sophisticated in GDP per capita terms, big theme of my book, Wages of Destruction. In relation to Imperial Japan, US GDP per capita, let alone total GDP, was about, you know, 2.5 to 3 times the Japanese, no, 2.5 times the Japanese GDP. And Japan is in level terms also at a much lower level than, say, Japan, the United States or Britain, which is why say Japan doesn't really have any tanks in World War II, right? Because they're not really a motorized society.
What about World War One? I mean, when
World War One, the crucial difference there is that America's outside and so not bled dry at the moment that it enters. Its advantage relative to the Central Powers is not as large as it will become because Fordism kicks in after the war, really, mass production on the huge scale. But America's financial power is enormous in World War One, and during World War One, the United States continental economy, the continental US economy, overtakes that of the entire British Empire combined in 1916. So that's a huge gear shift. The novelty of the confrontation with China is that for the first time with China, the United States faces an antagonist which is not obviously inferior in economic terms, in per capita terms, obviously, but in overall economic output terms, not. Depends on how you measure it. Purchasing power parity adjusted for inflation and cost of living, China's a little bit ahead. On currency, current currency, the United States is by a considerable margin ahead. If you actually look at physical production, China's electricity generation is twice that of the United States. So it's not a little bit ahead, it's twice as large. And in terms of steel production, it's more than 10 times larger than the United States. So that's part of what's so novel about the confrontation between the US and China is just simply the fact that America has never faced a player that was, you know, remotely in the same, well, in this case, in many metrics, larger than the US. The Soviet Union was never in that position. Another reason why it's not really sensible to compare this confrontation with the first Cold War, or rather comparing it reveals the very large differences.
So now if we were to look ahead and kind of speculate about the end of this war, and if we were just to kind of posit that whatever resulting civil war ensued, that it resulted in successful rebellion, and the United States is broken apart as a result. I mean, I'm curious, under what conditions would it be conceivable that, you know, the single market that is the United States could be recreated in the form, say, of kind of European Union-style arrangement? Obviously, the EU itself was formed after some cataclysmic wars in Europe. And so I'm curious, what conditions made that possible in 20th century Europe, and could they be replicated in a kind of, again, speculative 21st century post-Civil War America?
I mean, it's a horrifying thought. And I gather in the film, the précis I've read doesn't suggest that it ends, you know, I don't know really quite where this story is going. It just seems like a lot of slaughter going on. And that seems to be largely what the film is about, is actually journalism and reportage and voyeurism and the whole, anyway, it sounds interesting, but gruesome, not really my kind of bag right now. But I mean, the crucial point to make would be that in the scenario you're sketching, the US would be reintegrating after having lost its unity in a cataclysmic civil war. So what would be the analogy to that? I mean, in Europe, the analogy might be to the fall of the Roman Empire, in which case you'd be talking a millennium before, you know, or more before it's recomposed. Or more modestly, perhaps you might be thinking about the disintegration of the, you know, the Habsburg-dominated continental order anchored in Habsburg dynastic power and the Catholic Church, the kind of universal monarchy of Charles V in the early 1500s, which then disintegrated with the Reformation and the Wars of Religion and the culminating in the 30 Years' War, the Treaty of Westphalia, and, you know, the emergence de jure of something like the Westphalian system of sovereign states. Just as a shorthand, if that's the cataclysm that we're talking about, then it's several centuries before things grow back together again by way of the free trade politics of the 18th and 19th century, and then the horrific wars of the 20th, and then reunification. I mean, it's not for nothing that the premier prize awarded in Europe for service to the cause of European politics and European integration is the Karls Prize, is the Charlemagne Prize, awarded in Aachen, in Aix-la-Chapelle, the capital of the great Frankish ruler. And he ruled what became the Holy Roman Empire, the Carolingian Empire, between 800 and 814 AD. And so that gives you an idea of quite how long-lasting this will be. The one would imagine 1,200 years later, the United States awarding, I don't know, the George Washington Prize or something to somebody who managed to restore the fallen integrity of the greater United States project. It's a pretty grim vista.
I'm just glad that on the basis of this one Hollywood movie, we've managed to recount all of past 2,000 years of Western history. It's fascinating speculative project. I also have not seen the movie, but hopefully those who have can find this discussion enlightening, and also those who haven't. So we will leave it here for now, but as always, we will be back in your feeds next week. Ones and Twos is written and edited by me, Cameron Abadi, along with Adam Twos. It's produced by Claudia Tatey, Laura Rossbrow-Tellum, Rob Sachs, and Dan Efron. This show is made possible through the support of Foreign Policy Readers. If you're interested in news and analysis from around the world, consider subscribing. Listeners to Ones and Twos even get a 15% discount. Just go to foreignpolicy.com/subscribe and use the promo code TWOZ at checkout. That's TOOZE. And listeners, as always, we love getting your feedback. You can leave voice messages on the Ones and Twos homepage on foreignpolicy.com, or email us, podcast@foreignpolicy.com, or you can tweet us. That's @onesandtwospod. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in your feed next week.
Politics has never been stranger or more online, which is why the politics team at Wired is making a new show, Wired Politics Lab. It's all about how to navigate the endless stream of news and information and what to look out for. Each week on the show, we'll dig into far-right platforms, AI chatbots, influencer campaigns, and so much more. Wired Politics Lab launches Thursday, April 11th. Follow the show wherever you get your podcasts.